History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. On the night of June 1st, 1743, terror struck the schooner Rising Sun. After completing a routine smuggling voyage where the crew sold enslaved Africans in exchange for chocolate, sugar, and coffee in the Dutch colony of Suriname, the ship traveled eastward along the South American coast. Believing there was an opportunity to steal the lucrative cargo and make a new life for themselves, three sailors snuck below deck, murdered four people, and seized control of the vessel. Today's guest is Jared Hardesty, author of the book Mutiny on the Rising Sun, a tragic tale of slavery, smuggling, and chocolate. We discuss the origins and events and eventual fate of the Rising Sun's final smuggling voyage in vivid detail. It starts from that night in June 1743, and then we dive into the stories of those caught in the web spun by illicit commerce. Smuggling stood at the center of the lives of everyone involved with the business of the schooner. Larger forces, such as imperial trade restrictions, created the conditions for smuggling, but individual actors, often driven by raw ambition and with little regard for the consequences of their actions, designed, refined, and perpetuated this illicit commerce. Getting into the world of the 18th century, we learn a lot of different things. For example, if the smuggled goods were so valuable, why didn't sailors stage mutinies all the time? And we learn part of the reason is that piloting a ship is incredibly difficult. If you don't know what you're doing, you can easily get blown off course, run into a shoal, and die. We also look at the legacies of smuggling and how a lot of our modern institutions come from it. In fact, many of the institutions we have today, whether it's astronomy or chemistry, basically all modern sciences, owe to speculative sciences and superstitions like astrology and alchemy. And in many ways, modern-day capitalism owes much of its foundation to smuggling. So whether you like it or not, this is where we came from. This is a great look into a scandalous episode in the world that made ours. And I hope you enjoy this discussion with Jared Hardesty. Jared, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Well, this will be an interesting conversation. We were talking off air that this period in history is very interesting because colonial powers are being set up. You have European empires, proto-nation states that are trying to control colonies across the globe, but their reach extends beyond their grasp. And they're giving orders, they're trying to put down rebellions on another continent, and they're dispatching different people to do this, but they effectively have no control over what happens on the ground. For all intents and purposes, these people and colonies in North and South America might as well be on the New World. Plus, the sources we have aren't nearly as broad and diverse and detailed as those we have in later periods in the 19th and 20th century, so it's hard to decipher it and put it all together and reconstruct it, but it gives you a little bit of room of speculation. The end result is a lot of fun. So let's start off with the ship, the Rising Sun itself. What drew you to tell the story of the Rising Sun?
Well, it's kind of a funny story. So in September 2016, I received an invitation from the Old North Church and Historic Site in Boston, Massachusetts, to give a talk about my first book called Unfreedom, Slavery and Dependence in 18th Century Boston. And while I was there, I'd written about Old North a bit in the book, and so I wasn't surprised by the invitation. And while I was there, I was sitting in the parsonage, waiting, talking to the vicar and some of the interpretive staff at the Old North Church. And the vicar asked me if I knew of a man named Newark Jackson. And I said, no, I've never heard that name. And he said, you know, that's funny because you write about him in your book. And as the talk turns out, I talked about Newark Jackson as an example of a Boston slave owner. And so they asked me about this man and who he was. And they told me that they had a historic chocolate shop that was named after him. But they knew very little about him. They had some basic genealogical information, you know, what he married, how many kids he had, his occupation. He was a ship captain, a merchant, and one of the first chocolatiers in Boston. But beyond that, they didn't know much. And so I kind of became intrigued by this man. And so I agreed I'd do a little bit of research on him. And I wrote some friends at Leiden University in the Netherlands because I had heard they had this evidence that he was trading in the Dutch colony of Suriname in South America. And so I have a friend who named Carwin Fata Black at Leiden University, who had written a book about slavery and smuggling in Suriname, and had built a database of all these New England smugglers that were there. And lo and behold, that Newark Jackson was active trading in Suriname. But we'd also found evidence, Carwin had found, that Newark Jackson had been murdered in a mutiny in June 1743 when he was the captain of a ship called the Rising Sun. And so when we learn that, and we learn that, especially in the Dutch records, speaking of archives, in the Dutch records, there's this amazing record of the mutiny, of its aftermath. I really thought that there's something there that I should try to dig into this story and figure out a little more about the Rising Sun, Newark Jackson, and what exactly happened in that mutiny and why it mattered.
I'd like first to look at the larger forces that promote smuggling and piracy. Now, on the one hand, whenever you have a lack of a central authority, piracy seems to fill in that power vacuum. We see that off the coast of Somalia today. In the Roman imperial period, before the Roman Empire had any sort of navy, and they were never a great naval power, piracy always seems to pop up whenever there's nothing to really prevent it. So on the one hand, that makes sense. But on the other hand, what are other forces, like imperial trade restrictions or other conditions, that made smuggling so attractive at this time period?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's the big one, is, as you hinted at, is imperial trade restrictions. So there's a kind of governing economic principle of these European empires in the Americas, whether we talk about Britain, France, Spain, Portugal, the Netherlands, the Danish. They follow this loose economic ideology that historians call mercantilism. And essentially what it meant was kind of extreme protectionism. The fear was that if a nation's balance of trade was not in its favor, right, so they were importing more than they were exporting, this would do irreparable harm to the nation's economy and by extension, its politics. And so they sought to essentially try to control trade as much as possible, because they feared that on the margins of their empires, i.e. in the colonies, this is a place where the balance of trade could get way out of sync. It could become a real problem. They could hemorrhage wealth if their colonies are importing more than they're producing. So in the British case, they pass a set of laws that are called the Navigation Acts that are aimed at controlling the circulation of goods within the empire. And essentially what it dictates is that British ports can only trade with other British ports. If you want to import anything, you have to essentially buy it through London. It has to be imported into London and then shipped to the colonies. And today, of course, we have a fairly pejorative or negative understanding of smuggling. We think about the illegal drug trade, the illegal gun trade, things like that. But in this time period, these imperial trade restrictions extended to everyday household items. We're talking sugar, molasses, coffee, chocolate. All of these things fell under these imperial trade restrictions. And so what it meant was that anything that had to be imported into the empire became very expensive, because it was heavily tariffed, it was heavily taxed, it passed through the hands of multiple middlemen. And so for something, say, in the case of the British Empire, like chocolate, which there was not an extensive cacao growing in the British Empire in the 18th century, before about 1750 or so, for something like that, it all had to be imported. And if it was imported through legal channels, it just dramatically raised the price of goods. So that in itself incentivized smuggling. So instead of trying to import things through London, just go directly to the source. The other side of that is, it kind of also what you hinted at, is that, you know, the empires, it was very, they passed these laws, but they were near impossible to enforce. And so if you think about the way in which transportation and communication worked in the 18th century, it took on average 3 months to cross the Atlantic Ocean between Europe and North America. And ships moved, you know, at most 20 to 25 miles an hour. Like, that's really fast for a ship of the time period. And so it makes these laws near impossible to enforce by the Navy, by other, you know, customs officials, things like that. And so both because of the high prices on everyday goods that it had to be imported and the inability to enforce it, it totally incentivized smuggling, to the point that, you know, entire lives and entire economies revolved around smuggling. Anybody who was a consumer in the 18th century American colonies, that's North and South America, engaged in one way or the other in this 18th century economy. So essentially everybody did, or a smuggling economy. So essentially everybody did.
And one other thing to provide context for this period, the items under consideration that the smugglers are dealing with include slaves, chocolate, sugar, and coffee. And it's fascinating to read the things that are traded from the early age of discovery into the next few centuries, from the late 15th on to the 18th centuries. These staples, chocolate, sugar, and coffee, when they're first accessible to European markets, they're worth essentially more than gold. And when you read about say, Magellan's voyage, where crewmen are going to a voyage where essentially all of them could die, and essentially all of them do die, about 90% of them. When they return with cloves and spices, the amount of wealth is almost incalculable. And these items in the 18th century, chocolate, sugar, coffee, are they incredibly valuable, or is it simply because there's an embargo on them that they're artificially inflated, like the Dutch and their famous tulip exchange? And the reason I ask this is just, again, for modern listeners, when they hear these staples, they think of going to Costco and buying 5 pounds of them for $5. So how valuable are these items? Are they intrinsically valuable, or is it simply imperial policy that's making them valuable?
It's a little bit of both, actually. So by the 18th century, sugar, coffee, those sorts of things are becoming increasingly everyday items. In the 16th and 17th century, say 16th century when Magellan sailed, or even in the end of the 17th century, those things were luxuries, and they were, you know, like you said, worth their weight in gold and silver. But by the 18th century, what's happened is, especially the plantation complex that grows many of these, the use of enslaved labor on plantations in the American tropics to grow sugar and coffee and cacao, its productivity has reached, you know, new and higher profitability and productivity. And so what this has done, of course, it does drive down the price. But what it also means is, if we put it in the context of these empires that are restricting trade, what it means is that for some empires, those goods are much cheaper than others. So for example, one of the things that incentivized the smuggling of sugar and molasses from outside the British Empire into it to the British North American colonies that became the United States, one of the things that incentivized that was the fact that the Dutch and the French actually grew sugar cheaper than the British did. And they grew more of it. And their own imperial trade restrictions oftentimes lowered the price of things like molasses. So for example, the French Empire banned the production of rum to protect its brandy industry. So that meant that the French Empire had this huge surplus of molasses, the French sugar colonies had this huge surplus of molasses. And so it's a little bit of both that's happening, right? These goods are becoming intrinsically valuable because more and more people can buy them. But because of the imperial trade restrictions, what it means is that in some cases, it's actually significantly cheaper to go outside the empire to buy these goods because those empires are more efficient at producing, say, sugar, or their own trade restrictions are driving down the price of commodities that say, North Americans consumers want.
I want to get more into how you reconstruct this story, because a central government is not typically going to tell the truth about banditry and smuggling. Even if they know what's going on, they're going to spin it in the best way possible, especially for the fact that they're often trying to co-opt a lot of these people. And there's not much of a difference between a smuggler and a naval officer at this time. Sometimes they're doing both. Sometimes a smuggler is given a rank of a naval officer. If you can't beat them, join them. Lots of interesting things. But let's get to the story of the Rising Sun itself. So could you begin on June 1st, 1743? How does this story begin, and what are the initial events that kicked this off?
Well, so we have to go actually back a little bit further to get to the night of June 1st. So we're not really sure when, but sometime in the middle of May 1743, the rising sun, or kind of early to middle May, the rising sun left the British West Indian colony of Barbados. It's captained by Newark Jackson, who I've mentioned already. It also, there's 11 crew members on board. So Newark Jackson, he has a mate named William Blake, the ship's bosun named John Shaw. There's two young New England boys who are kind of young adult men who were sailors. There's also a merchant on board by the name of George Ladane, who served as the ship's supercargo, so the guy who managed the cargo. And it's kind of, there's a question why he's on board. I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit. And he has a clerk who's on board. And then there's three other sailors whose names are Ferdinand Acosta, Thomas Lucas, and Joseph Perea. And these men are described in the documents as Portuguese sailors, or, quote, Portuguese Negro sailors. Two of them are of mixed race. And they are hired by Jackson in Barbados to serve as the ship's able seamen. So these guys have decades of experience as sailors at sea. So the ship leaves Barbados sometime early to mid-May, and it arrived in Suriname in late May. And the Dutch and British are on different calendars during this time. So essentially, when they arrived in the Dutch and the Dutch Empire, the Suriname, it's 12 days ahead. So it's it's actually early June on the Dutch calendar. It's a bit confusing, but we can talk about that too. Or late May, early June. And so they arrive in Suriname, and Newark Jackson claims that the ship is in dire need of repair. They need water. They need wood for cooking. And under international treaty law, the Dutch governor in Suriname cannot deny the ship safe harbor. And so they use this as a ploy, as a disguise that they have to smuggle their cargo on. And the Rising Sun cargo has a number of commodities from New England, some saltfish, some timber, but its main cargo was probably about 50 to 60 enslaved African captives that had been purchased in Barbados from the transatlantic slave trade and placed on board the ship. So over the next week, this illicit cargo of both living and the New England produce is gradually moved off the Rising Sun as its hold is filled with tropical commodities, most important of which was cacao. So finally, on May 31st, 1743, the governor of Suriname's quite angry, at least in his own journals, quite angry with the Rising Sun for malingering. They're ordered to leave with haste. They'd stationed soldiers on board the ship. He was so afraid that it was a smuggling vessel. So they finally depart. They drop the soldiers off at one of the main forts near the mouth of the Suriname River, Fort New Amsterdam. And then they overnight at the mouth of the Suriname River at a place called Brahms Point, which was a common place for ships to stop to take on wood and water before leaving the colony. The next morning, they catch the low tide out of the Suriname River to take them out into the Atlantic Ocean. And what the ship begins doing then is a thing that the sailing ships do called tacking. It begins essentially a zigzag pattern moving eastward, ever gradually eastward. And the reason it has to zigzag is it's fighting the wind and the predominant winds and currents on the northern coast of South America because they're headed to the French colony of Cayenne. So it's starting to make good progress towards French Guiana. And at about 11 p.m. on that night, the mate goes to bed, the two younger sailors go to bed, two of the able-bodied sailors, in theory, go to bed as well. And so they're on what's called the captain's watch, when Newark Jackson's supposed to be in charge of the ship. And on the watch with him are John Shaw, the bosun, and Joseph Pereira, one of the Portuguese sailors. Of course, Newark Jackson is the captain. He's privileged, so he decides to go to bed. It's 11 p.m. He's going to bed, even if it is his own watch. That's the privilege of being captain. And John Shaw is piloting the ship along with Joseph Pereira. And Joseph Pereira strikes up a conversation with John Shaw, and he asks him about the compass on board the ship and if he was interested in going to Orinoco in what is today Eastern Venezuela. It was a Spanish colony in this time period. If he was interested in going to Orinoco, what direction the compass should point. John Shaw decided to humor him, didn't see anything wrong with it, and said, told him, you know, you'd head west. And then Pereira continued asking kind of annoying questions of Shaw. And so Shaw finally said, you know, you just leave me alone. Go get me a dram of rum. You know, go get me a drink. So Pereira goes down below deck and he takes forever, about 15, 20 minutes. He comes back above deck with no rum. And so John Shaw's a little annoyed. And Pereira begins asking the same questions. What way to Orinoco? How's the compass work? Et cetera, et cetera. And John Shaw's finally just kind of dismisses him and says, hey, go get me that drink. So Pereira goes down, and about 10 minutes later, all hell breaks loose on the ship. Pereira, it seems, awoke the other two, or perhaps they were already awake. They were already talking. The other two Portuguese men, Ferdinand da Costa and Thomas Lucas, and they go into the cabin of Newark Jackson. They split up. Two of them go into the cabin of Newark Jackson. One goes into George Ladain's cabin, and they begin stabbing and cutting using knives, Ladain and Jackson. Ladain and Jackson flee. They begin to try to get up on the deck of the ship. As they're trying to get up on the deck of the ship, they're being stabbed. Ladain's clerk wakes up. He's stabbed 9 times. So the captain and the supercargo do get up on the deck of the ship eventually. They're followed by the mutineers now. John Shaw is watching this happen. That spills out onto the deck of the ship. He's still above deck. George Ladain dies on deck pretty quickly thereafter from his wounds. Newark Jackson, one of the mutineers who came up after him was carrying an axe and dropped the axe to kind of finish Ladain off. And so Jackson had grabbed the axe, but it's Ferdinand da Costa takes the axe from him and began chopping, essentially. Meanwhile, the screams of Jackson and Ladain woke the mate, William Blake, up, who he comes up on deck to see what's happening, and he's stabbed in the shoulder. And so he kind of lays on the deck and watches all this happen. They then attack John Shaw, the bosun. They slash him to pieces, and he's about to be finished when they decide they have to get rid of Jackson the LaDain. And this gives Shaw a chance to escape into his berth, into his bunk below deck. And the cabin boy of the ship, a boy named John Skinner, who was sleeping in Newark Jackson's cabin, he'd also come on deck and at this point was unwounded. He's scared. He's like 12 or so. And so he when he sees the mutineers decide to come after him, he goes up the shrouds of the ship, which are those kind of netted ropes that go up the side of a mast on a sailing ship. Eventually, Ferdinand Acosta coaxes him down, promising that he'll be spared. But the moment the boy's feet hit the deck, he's bludgeoned and thrown overboard. George LaDain's body's thrown overboard. And then two of the mutineers pick up Newark Jackson, you know, kind of swing his body to get momentum and throw him overboard. He's actually still alive. He's described as screaming as he falls into the water. Meanwhile, the mate, William Blake's wounded on deck, but it's clear the mutineers don't want to harm him. And so they decide to go below deck and find LaDain's the merchant's clerk, a man named John McCoy, who they do find, and they finish him and throw him overboard. But they also decide that they're going to kill John Shaw, the bosun. And this is where William Blake intervened and stopped them from killing John Shaw, telling the mutineers that this man has an extremely deep knowledge of this region, and anywhere you want to sail to, you're going to need him to be alive. And so this is so very quickly, the mutiny probably took place over about 15-20 minutes from about 11:40 to about midnight, you know, June 1st into June 2nd. So it was over, and the mutineers had control of the ship, or so they thought.
Well, I'll definitely want to pick up on the story, but one short tangent. I wonder how common were mutinies like this when you have incredibly valuable cargo? You're a crew that is already engaged in somewhat illicit activity anyway, and all it would take is doing something like this, and you could, if successful, be fabulously wealthy if you're able to steer it to a port, have a plausible story, find traders, sell the cargo, and end up far wealthier than you could ever imagine as a simple sailor. Is something like this common at this time period?
No, not at all. I mean, it's totally logical, and it sounds, you know, as you phrased it perfectly, like there is this, you can totally understand the logic as to why these men would do this. It makes total sense, but it actually happening was very rare. And in fact, I'm sure we're going to get into this, but the way in which this whole thing ended and went down actually tells us why it wasn't more common. What it really boils down to is that these sailors, right? It's so easy to be enticed by that vast wealth on the ship. One of the things that the Rising Sun had on board, for example, was a lot of gold and silver. And I still am not entirely sure why. Part of it, I think, is that they're selling African captives on board for cash, so hard money, silver and gold. But there's even more than that suggests, or what than that trade would suggest. And so we can understand the way they'd be enticed. But the thing is that regular sailors, like those three mutineers, despite having decades of sailing experience, probably didn't, they didn't know how to pilot a ship. So they had no understanding of how to navigate or how to pilot a ship. This is why they kept the mate alive. The mate of a ship is the chief navigator. And the reason they keep John Shaw alive, the bosun ultimately, is because he's familiar with that region. And so it was really hard for them while they can understand, you know, the kind of day-to-day rhythms of ship life, hoisting sails, dealing with ropes, all of that sort of stuff, the more technical part of, say, of piloting and navigating a ship, they don't know. And so they're reliant upon the expertise of these officers who now are, of course, incentivized to stop the mutiny, if at all possible.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Right, and I'm not a scholar of naval history, but for listeners who want to check out a companion episode that explains this in more detail, look up one on the history of clocks and timekeeping devices. Basically, the most cutting-edge technology in the 18th century was accurate timekeeping devices that let you determine where you were east or west. Astronomy would let you figure out north or south, but you have to reference astronomical charts, sophisticated maps, and all these other things so you don't hit a shoal. It's not just a matter of being able to move a sail like you're on a sailboat and have your Boy Scout compass to get into a harbor. It's a lot more complicated than that to pilot a ship. So not just any sailor who's been at sea a couple of times, a salty sea dog can't figure it out. So excellent point. Thank you. So where does the Rising Sun go from here?
So what's going to happen is very quickly, Blake and Shaw swing into action. They know that they do hold the cards, essentially. As much as the mutineers might think that they're in charge and they start, you know, rummaging through the cargo, Ferdinand Acosta puts on George LaDain's fancy clothes and is as he's described, the pretended captain. I just think of the Tom Hanks movie, I'm the Captain Now, Ferdinand Acosta doing that sort of thing. The John Shaw tries to say, you know, actually, I should be in charge of this vessel because I know what I'm doing. I know where I am. And Ferdinand Acosta replies, no, we're all captains now. So they try to impose this kind of democratic, you know, structure on board what's left of the crew. But the thing is that it's very clear that because of their lack of navigational knowledge, it's going to be very hard for the mutineers to accomplish their goals. They want to go to Orinoco, the Spanish colony. Now, this is one of the, we talk about speculation, and so one of the most perplexing things about this story is why they would want to go there. I think that by speculating the book, these are men who have decades of experience at sea. In fact, Thomas Lucas, who seemed to be kind of the ringleader-ish of it all, of the mutiny, he is like about 35 years old, 35, 36 years old. And that's very old for a sailor in this time period. So he's been at sea since he's about 10. So we're talking like, you know, 25 years of experience at sea, and his body's starting to give out. He has to serve as the ship's cook in addition to a sailor to make, even begin to make the wages as close to that of Da Costa and Perea. So he's starting to age out of this profession. And so these guys have, you know, collective knowledge of living on the sea for decades. And they've probably heard stories about Orinoco, which the Spanish in 1704 passed a law in Orinoco in Venezuela that allows them to openly welcome runaway soldiers, runaway sailors, runaway slaves, as long as those runaways were Catholic and pledged loyalty to the Spanish crown. And these three men were, you know, quote unquote Portuguese. They're not all Portuguese, as later found out. Lucas is Italian, actually, but they are all Catholic. So they have, you know, they check one of the boxes. And so the idea is that they could go to this colony, which itself is relative, Orinoco, which is relatively marginal in the Spanish Empire. This is one of the reasons it has that policy of welcoming runaways, is to bolster the colony's population and economy. So they could show up with a valuable cargo of goods, sell it, and perhaps settle down and live there, or perhaps take the profits and go elsewhere. The thing is, though, that it's a good plan on paper. I don't honestly think it would work. The most valuable thing on board the Rising Sun at this point is a cargo full of cacao. Venezuela's main export in this time period was cacao. So I don't know if it would come to a particularly good market when they did arrive, but they had some other goods as well. But also, because they didn't know how to navigate the ship, they're completely dependent upon Blake and Shaw. And Blake and Shaw, of course, are not particularly happy about how this has transpired. So what they do is, over the next 4 days, the ship just kind of moves slowly westward across the coast of Suriname. And this is a key thing to understand, that it would have been very easy to get to Orinoco from Suriname very quickly. If the ship had just sailed a little further northward, it would have gotten caught in what's called the South Equatorial Current, which runs from West Africa along the northeastern coast of South America. And it would essentially drop you at the island of Barbados in the West Indies. But they could take that pretty far and move pretty fast and not have to worry about sailing. So they should have been to Orinoco in a couple of days. But the ship lingers south of that current for 4 days, moving slowly across the northern coast of Suriname. And on the fifth day, they get to the mouth of a very large river. And Blake and Shaw, of course, know this is not the Orinoco, but the mutineers don't. And so Blake and Shaw tell them this is the Orinoco. Blake says, if this isn't the Orinoco, you can cut my head off. The high tide starts coming in late morning on that fifth day, and the Rising Sun begins moving up this river. It moves up the river, moves about 60 miles up the river, and they come to an outpost there. And out of the outpost, so the crew save John Shaw, who they keep on board the ship. It's pretty clear the mutineers don't trust him at all, so they keep him on board the ship. But the rest of the crew, Blake, the mutineers, the two young sailors, they go on shore to this house. Out comes a group of men, and the men speak Dutch to them. They're actually still in Suriname. They're just in what's called the Quarantine River. And so this is the moment Blake pretends that he messed up navigating. He uses this as an excuse to go back to the ship, to get his instruments, to get his books. He brings Shaw back with him. Shaw is a Dutch speaker, explains everything that happened. And essentially, the mutineers do catch on after staying at this outpost till late in the evening. They realize what's wrong. So they go back to the Rising Sun. They're very angry. Perea wants to murder Shaw and Blake right then and there. But DaCosta says it's more important to get out of here than we'll murder them. So the tide is going out on the Quarantine River. All these rivers on the northern coast of South America use the tide. So the tide's going out. So the water's moving fast. So they literally cut the... Eventually, Perea wins the argument, says, we're going to murder John Shaw. But as they decide to do this, John Shaw jumps overboard. He gets into the ship's boat, rows to shore. DaCosta freaks out, cuts the anchor rope of the ship, and the Rising Sun begins moving very rapidly out with the low tide, with the low tide going out. The ship runs aground. Meanwhile, Shaw gets to shore, and the Dutch officer there, a man named Jan Heijs. Jan Heijs, his job is to conduct diplomacy with the local Native American population called Amerindians in South America. And even before this all went, before the Rising Sun left, Heijs began gathering a group of indigenous warriors. And so the next day, when the high tide comes back in, the Rising Sun floats, but immediately runs aground again, just a little bit further upriver. It's very clear that at this point, these mutineers have no idea how to control the ship. So Heijs and his Amerindian warriors, John Shaw, they then go after the Rising Sun. About 50 warriors, some Dutch soldiers, John Shaw and Corporal Heijs, they stop the mutiny. They essentially board the ship. Joseph Perea wanted to fight, but the ship had one tiny cannon, only had one bottle of gunpowder. These three men, once again, had no idea how to use a cannon, despite being on ships their whole lives. So very quickly, they're encircled, they're captured. Except Joseph Perea, who jumps overboard into the Quarantine River and runs into the jungle. But the other two, Thomas Lucas and Fernando Costa, are arrested, and they are sent to Paramaribo, the capital of Suriname, for a trial. Meanwhile, Heijs hires a posse of Amerindian warriors to seek out Joseph Perea in the jungle. It's unclear how long, it's a matter of days, these warriors hunt him down. And when they finally surround him, he kills himself before being taken. And the Amerindians behead him as proof, and his head is sent to Paramaribo as evidence in the trial. So that's how the mutiny ended.
Very clear cut. What happened to the other two sailors?
So we don't know a lot about them. Their names are Josiah Jones and Henry Devries. They're young New England men. Henry Devries, I found a little bit of evidence after the mutiny. He lived in Boston. They're probably, about anywhere from 18 to 22, 23 years old. This may have been their actual first voyage at sea. Most likely, definitely their first voyage away from a kind of coastal waters of New England. So that would have been quite the adventure. We don't know much more about them. I'm pretty sure that they're left. they're left alive because the mutineers either saw them as totally powerless or as possible allies. But they survive. They're part of the group testimony in the trial against the mutineers. But other than that, we don't know much about them.
Presumably the mutineers were found guilty, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. there was one of the things that I found, I had to learn about, Dutch legal process. I'm pretty familiar with the British side of things from other work, but I had to learn about the way that the Dutch court system worked in this time period, and especially its colonial court system. And there was never a presumption of innocence. Right. Like we take it for granted that people are presumed, innocent until proven guilty sort of thing. There was none of that. Like they're just assumed guilty from the moment they show up. And so what that means is the court process isn't so much aimed about, getting at things like motive. So we don't have a statement of motive about why they mutinied. But it also, so there's none of that is really part of the trial. Really what it's aimed at, the proceedings, is it extracting a confession. And so what this means is that the court gathers the testimony of the other crew and ensures that, that's like their kind of master narrative of what happened, what Blake and Shaw, Jones and Devries, what they say, that's the kind of master narrative. And now what their goal is to question the mutineers, figure out who they were, and then make them essentially confess and cop to the narrative that's already been established. Fernando Costa goes along with it he's very open and honest. This is where we learn about his background. He was actually white. He had no African ancestry. He was born in a small fishing village outside of Lisbon, Portugal, and had been at sea for quite a while. he cooperates. He answers all their questions. Of course, he tries to pin it all on the other two mutineers, but there's the he's pretty clearly resigned to his fate. At the end of the interview, at the end of the interrogation, they ask him, you know, do you think you should be executed for your crimes? And he essentially replies, it doesn't matter how I answer, you're going to execute me anyways. Thomas Lucas, however, was much more intransigent. He refused to answer over half the questions. He does answer the early questions. So we learn that he's partially of African descent. His mother was enslaved, an enslaved woman, and his father was probably his mother's enslaver. And he was born outside of Venice in Italy and had been at sea for a very long time. But beyond that, he refuses to answer questions about how the mutiny went down, who planned it, how they acted, who murdered who. He's very dicey about that. To the point, at one time, he's taken into the same interrogation chamber as Da Costa, and they're kind of forced to confront each other and get the story straight. He does eventually confess, and it's unclear if it came after this joint interrogation, or there is a possibility, as was commonly used in the Dutch system at this time, but he was tortured, especially in the Dutch colonies against people of African descent. The Dutch still employed torture, although they still did it in Europe. They were one of the few European nations that still used judicial torture by the mid-18th century. But so there is a possibility that he was tortured to extract his confession, and they are executed.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. What was the legacy of this event and this case? Because obviously with important land-breaking cases, there can be multiplier effects down the road. So what is the legacy that you see of this?
The legacy, that's a really good question, because it's really hard for, you know, one voyage to leave this great legacy. Certainly for the survivors, for the investors in the voyage, for the widows of the men who were murdered, for the friends and merchants of the crew and supercargo, it was a tragedy. You know, they lost a father, they lost a husband, they lost a friend. But for the bigger picture, why does this matter? What is its legacy it leaves behind? I think there's kind of two things it shows. The first is that the only reason we know about this voyage is because of the mutiny. If the mutiny hadn't happened, this would have been one of thousands upon thousands of these anonymous smuggling voyages that we know happened, because we know the volume of trade, we know what people are buying and selling. It's oftentimes really hard to see. And so what the documents from the mutiny do is they open a window on a world that contemporaries deliberately and emphatically shut, right? Like nobody wants, although everyone practices smuggling, no one's kind of open about it, right? No one's kind of out in the open advertising this, because that could bring its own legal troubles. And so this, like I said, this is something that contemporaries don't want people seeing, don't want them knowing about. And the mutiny opens up that world in a very particular way. So there's a lot of details we don't have. Frustratingly so. So one of the things that I always like to say about this is, you know, I can tell you how Newark Jackson was murdered in just the bloodiest, most gruesome detail possible, down to the number of axe wounds he had when he was thrown overboard while he's still alive. But I can't tell you how old he was when he died. We just don't have those types of records. So those basic biographical details can be hard to find. And so it opens the window in a certain way. So I think that's one of the important legacies, is that it allows us to see what is absolutely routine in every day. And it shows, because the ship carried African captives, just how important and central slavery was to this kind of routine smuggling, whether it was the buying and selling of slave-produced commodities like sugar, molasses, cacao, or the use of African captives as a trade good. And so that's one of the legacies, right? Is it just kind of opens up this world in a way that otherwise is really hard to get at. You know, the way that historians have talked about smuggling has long been the volume of trade, the laws restricting smuggling, and hasn't been about the people involved and what it meant to live in a world of smuggling and how that, you know, affected their lives. So that's one of the legacies, I think, for us today for the Mutiny on the Rising Sun. I also think, though, and I talk about this in the book, that it illustrates something else that's happening within the British Empire in this time period, in the 1740s, in the 1750s, that's going to become very important in the 1760s and 1770s. You begin to see the rift between the North American colonies and the rest of the British Empire, especially the people in London, so the metropole, and people in the and colonists in the West Indian colonies. And of course, that imperial rift is the American Revolution. You know, it's going to culminate in this nasty imperial divorce that we call the American Revolution in the 1770s and 1780s. And the reason it does that is that the kind of chief organizer of this voyage and the smuggling ring this voyage was part of was a man named Gedney Clark. Gedney Clark was born in Salem, Massachusetts, but he moved to Barbados in the early 1730s. And throughout his career, before his death in 1764, he will become one of the richest men in the British Empire. And he's a plantation owner, slaveholder, merchant, and he's a major smuggler. So he's the kind of organizer of smuggling rings. I don't do it in the book, but in talks and things, I call him the godfather of the smuggling ring and many others. So he is the partial owner of the Rising Sun and its chief investor. And he's backed by a major London merchant firm called the Lascelles family. The Lascelles and Maxwell is the firm's name. And one of the things you see in the aftermath of the mutiny on the Rising Sun, as they're trying to figure out the cargo, as they're trying to, they've taken out an insurance policy on the ship, hoping that, you know, if something went wrong, like a mutiny, they would get £1,500 sterling in insurance to make up for the cost of the ship and its original cargo of enslaved Africans and New England produce. They are reliant upon a man to ensure they get this insurance claim, to resolve this whole debacle and put it behind them. They were dependent on a man named Edward Tuttle, who had lived in Boston before moving to Suriname. And he's this smuggling ring's kind of guy on the ground. He's the one that's moving the captives and other goods off the Rising Sun into his warehouse in Paramaribo in this time period. And he's also described in the documents as, quote, good friends with George LaDane, the murdered supercargo. And so he is the one who has to take care of this, to send all the documents to London, to get the insurance claim, to put the case of the Rising Sun behind its investors. George LaDane was also the supercargo, was also a partial owner of the Rising Sun. And so what it does, it sets up this moment where it's competing interests between Gedney Clark and his London financiers, the Lascelles and Maxwell, and Edward Tuttle and his good friend and New England merchant, George LaDane, and especially George LaDane's widow, a woman named Mary LaDane. So it sets that, it kind of sets this up as a conflict between them. And Edward Tuttle chose his good friend and his good friend's widow over the interest of the other investor, Gedney Clark, the organizer of the smuggling ring, and the London investors. And what you see after this, Gedney Clark, who's this mover and shaker in the British Empire, gradually after the Rising Sun, kind of withdraws from conducting business with New England, his home, his kind of home region. He begins focusing more of his attention on getting investment from London and investing it in the plantation colonies, moving away from dealing with New Englanders, especially in these kind of elaborate smuggling schemes where he could be essentially screwed over. And this is indicative of a larger change that's happening in the British Empire as the West Indian colonies become increasingly committed for a whole variety of reasons to the metropole, to the need for finance from London, to the need for commerce from London, for the need for army and navy protection in London, whereas the North American colonists are kind of beginning to blaze their own very different path forward to do this. So it's indicative of this kind of rift that's growing in the British Empire that will result in the American Revolution.
And one last thing about the legacy of smuggling. When we consider our modern society, I think it's always helpful to understand how many of our institutions that we consider as being legitimate and modern often have very unsavory beginnings, sort of like the way that the wealthiest families in America were founded by a Cornelius Vanderbilt or other people who are basically poor immigrants that could barely read and use chewing tobacco and everything else. And there's all sorts of examples. Modern chemistry comes from alchemy. Modern astronomy owes an enormous debt to astrology. Many of the governments that exist in Europe were essentially centuries ago competing against other small kingdoms that were more or less mafia families, and they were the strongest mafia family, managed to take on institutional control, and then had all the trappings of modernity and running a clean government and other things else, and were able to paper over their unsavory past. Are there any institutions like that in contemporary society, say the United States or elsewhere, that owe a debt, one could say, to smuggling?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the... You can't walk the streets of Boston, Massachusetts, without seeing institutions in which the wealth comes from illicit trade. And the other key thing to remember is it's illicit trade that's oftentimes, almost always tied in one way or the other to slavery, right? Whether it is the actual slave trade, as we see with the case of the Rising Sun, or if it's a little more abstract, dealing in slave-produced commodities like molasses, chocolate, sugar, things like that, right? That's where the profits of smuggling come from, is in slave-produced produce, goods. So what that means is that, like, any institution in Boston that existed before the American Revolution, when these, you know, navigation acts were in place, owe its existence, a lot of its wealth, to smuggling, and especially that smuggling's connection to slavery. And so I think about, you know, the organization I worked very closely with for this book, the Old North Church. You know, these smugglers, Newark Jackson, George LaDane, another captain who part of the smuggler named William Wingfield, Edward Tottle, when he did live in Boston, they were all congregants at Old North, and they donated money. They paid for the steeple. They bought pews. They paid for the peal of bells. Geddy Clark, despite living in Barbados, was the matched for the largest donor for the peal of bells, the set of bells in Old North that are still in the Old North Church's bell tower today. He's a, you know, tied for £100 sterling he committed to paying for these bells. And so these institutions are absolutely tied. Their existence, their continued existence, their foundations are tied to this world of smuggling. Faneuil Hall, named after Peter Faneuil, who made the wealthiest man in Boston, made his wealth from smuggling and slave trading as well. Harvard, so much of their colonial era endowment, buildings and donations all come from the profits of illicit trade. So yeah, it's one of those things that if these existed, you know, before the end of the Navigation Acts, they absolutely, these institutions owe so much of their existence and their foundations to the profits of smuggling.
It was a harder time, but, you know, I think it's helpful to understand the context of where we've come from. And the story that you presented here is a great example of what things were like in that world. And for listeners who want to dig into the story much more deeply, the name of your book is Mutiny on the Rising Sun, A Tragic Tale of Slavery, Smuggling, and Chocolate. Jared, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Scott. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
That's all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes with sources, maps, links, anything else related to this episode, and all my other ones as well, go to parthenonpodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network this show is a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the membership program for History Unplugged. If you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes for the entire back catalog, which is about 600 episodes and growing. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/unplug. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.